Lie number 12. The Muslim Brotherhood is a moderate mainstream Islamic group. The term Muslim Brotherhood is an umbrella term for a variety of movements. In the case of Egypt, a very heterogeneous group, largely secular, which has eschewed violence and has decried Al-Qaeda as a perversion of Islam. They have pursued social ends, a betterment of the political order. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, 2011. Allah is our objective. The Prophet is our leader. The Quran is our law. Jihad is our way. Dying in the way of Allah is our highest hope. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Muslim Brotherhood chant. Hassan al-Banna created the Muslim Brotherhood, or Ikhwan, as it's called in Arabic, in 1928 as a way of reestablishing the caliphate. Since that time, it has counted among its members jihadist luminaries such as Sayyid Qutb and Ayman al-Zawahiri. The sprawling group now has chapters in countries around the world, including a well-connected and increasingly powerful American one. In 2011, the Brotherhood's large Egyptian arm seized power after the ouster of Hosni Mubarak during the Arab Spring. They did this with the active, even vocal backing of the Obama administration. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with then-Muslim Brotherhood ruler Mohamed Morsi in Cairo. 3 years later, Morsi was convicted by an Egyptian court and sentenced to death for his part in the uprising. That might be surprising, except that 2 years earlier, Obama had invited Brotherhood members to his Cairo speech. President Obama and his intelligence chief James Clapper apparently believe that the Muslim Brotherhood is the good guy Islamist alternative to bad guys like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The Brotherhood, in their view, is moderate and mainstream and worthy of our support. Nothing could be further from the truth. It was almost by accident that the FBI discovered the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood in North America. Had Ismail el-Barassi not been detained on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge with his wife in August 2004, we might still be under the illusion that the Brotherhood and its affiliated groups in America were the simple secular advocacy groups they claimed to be, just another identity group, lobbying organization, like an NAACP or Catholic League for Muslims. But after el-Barassi's wife was caught videotaping the support structures of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge from their car, suspicions were raised. When authorities pulled over the car, they discovered an outstanding warrant for el-Barassi. It turns out he was wanted as a material witness in a case concerning fundraising for Hamas. The FBI subsequently executed a search warrant on the el-Barassi's house. Hidden in a sub-basement in their Annandale, Virginia home were 80 banker boxes worth of documents. These papers confirmed what most counterterrorism experts had long suspected. Many of the Muslim American groups in the United States were controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood, and their goals, as clearly outlined in the documents, were anything but benign. Among the documents was one called an explanatory memorandum on the General Strategic Group for the Group in North America. Dated May 22, 1991, the memo was written by Muhammad Akram, a member of the board of directors for the Muslim Brotherhood and a leader of Hamas, and had been approved by the Brotherhood's Shura Council. It is 16 pages of chilling reading, but here's the key passage. The process of settlement is a civilization jihadist process with all the word means. The Ikhwan, Arabic for Muslim Brotherhood, must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers, so that it is eliminated and God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. Akram had no intention of any non-Brotherhood member ever seeing the memo, but the FBI presented it as evidence in a 2007 terrorism financing trial. As a result, the Muslim Brotherhood's plan to transform America into an Islamist society became public for the first time. Contrary to the opinions of pacifists and apologists, the Muslim Brotherhood didn't just spawn the world's most lethal terrorist groups. It is just as committed to the destruction of Western secular democracy as its more violent cousins. As Muhammad Badia, the Brotherhood's supreme guide, put it, "Resistance is the only solution against the Zio-American arrogance and tyranny." He also explained how that resistance would need to work. The improvement and change that the Muslim nation seeks can only be attained by raising a jihadi generation that pursues death just as the enemies pursue life. The Muslim Brotherhood is committed to a long-term civilization jihad, a term the Brotherhood uses and mentioned in its explanatory memorandum to distinguish itself from the more violent forms of jihad. In some ways, this type of jihad actually poses a more insidious long-term threat to the West. While it may not involve detonating suicide vests and beheading infidels, it is a plan to influence and infiltrate Western societies through dawah, which literally means the calling of non-Muslims to join Islam or proselytism. We will conquer Europe, we will conquer America, not through the sword, but through dawah, says Youssef al-Qaradawi, Egypt's leading Muslim Brotherhood scholar. Dawah, in case you were wondering, is the principal means of the Muslim Brotherhood's stealthy civilization jihad. The Brotherhood's goal is nothing less than to Islamicize our free societies. They are working toward that goal through political and psychological warfare that includes cultural subversion, the co-opting of senior leaders, influence operations, propaganda, and other means of pushing Sharia into Western societies bit by bit. This is a highly coordinated effort that shames and intimidates opponents, while persuading allies and fence-sitters that Sharia and submission to Islam are the correct path. We should all be very careful not to be colonized by something which is coming from this consumerist society, said Tariq Ramadan, grandson of the Muslim Brotherhood's founder, Hassan al-Banna. It should be us with our understanding of Islam, our principles, colonizing positively the United States of America. This from a man that Time magazine listed among the world's top thinkers, and whom Slate called one of the most important intellectuals in the world, and the Muslim Martin Luther. The Brotherhood's plan starts with the creation of small Muslim enclaves, communities that are entirely separate from the secular laws of our nations and in which Muslims are free to live under Sharia. Were we to convince Western leaders and decision makers of our right to live according to our faith, ideologically, legislatively, and ethically, without imposing our views or inflicting harm upon them, we would have traversed an immense barrier in our quest for an Islamic state, the Brotherhood's Qaradawi has said. That exact thing is already happening in Europe, where vigilante Sharia squads are popping up, enforcing rules, prohibiting alcohol, and haranguing people who don't dress modestly enough. Key to the Brotherhood's plans is a rejection of assimilation and maintaining the Islamic supremacist view of the Dar al-Islam, House of Islam, opposing the Dar al-Harb, House of War, or the rest of us. This is where the Brotherhood's commitment to dawah is problematic for those of us here in America who believe that our Constitution should be the law of the land for all of our citizens, no matter their religion. This is the civilization jihad in action, a parallel but more subtle agenda compared to the violent jihad pursued by ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Both are necessary for them to achieve their goals. Both are working. One of the most troubling things about the Muslim Brotherhood is the slippery way in which the group denies any association with the Islamic supremacist tenets it espouses. They are seemingly okay with these lies because of the concept that lying in defense of Islam is not only permissible, it is encouraged. The Reliance of the Traveler, a legal text cited by many Islamic scholars and a go-to for the Muslim Brotherhood, counsels, "This is an explicit statement that lying is sometimes permissible for a given interest. When it is possible to achieve such an aim by lying but not by telling the truth, it is permissible to lie if attaining the goal is permissible and obligatory to lie if the goal is obligatory." This is known as the Islamic doctrine of taqiyya, lying for the sake of Islam. Quran 3:28 says, "Let not the believers take the disbelievers as awliya, supporters, helpers, etc., instead of the believers, and whoever does that will never be helped by Allah in any way, except if you indeed fear a danger from them." Taqiyya is used to conceal, obfuscate, or disguise one's beliefs or convictions to confuse the enemy. It's a classic technique used by the Muslim Brotherhood when they say one thing to Westerners and the opposite to their followers. It's why Essam el-Erian, member of the Egyptian Brotherhood's Guidance Council, took to the pages of the New York Times at the height of the Arab Spring to proclaim, We aim to achieve reform and rights for all, not just for the Muslim Brotherhood, not just for Muslims, but for all Egyptians. They sought nothing of the sort. Soon after the Brotherhood consolidated power, Coptic Christians were massacred and persecuted. The Muslim Brotherhood has integrated itself into American culture by using various front groups, which don't come with the violence and terror-connected baggage, to promote its cause. For example, the Brotherhood created the Muslim Students Association, MSA, to organize on campuses as well as numerous other groups, the Association of Muslim Social Scientists, AMSS, the Association of Muslim Scientists and Engineers, AMSE, the Islamic Medical Association, IMA, the Muslim Community Association, MCA, and others. The brothers also formed other student groups in the 1970s, including the Muslim Arab Youth Assembly, MAYA, and Muslim Youth of North America, MYNA, and the Islamic Society of North America, ISNA. Some governments already recognized the threat posed by the Muslim Brotherhood. In November 2014, the Cabinet of the United Arab Emirates published a list of terrorist organizations that makes no distinction between groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, and the Muslim Brotherhood. But not the United States government. Our leaders seem to think these guys are our friends. As counterterrorism intelligence officer Stephen Coughlin recounts in October 2011, individuals associated with the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood wrote to the White House demanding an embargo or discontinuation of the dissemination of information or materials relating to Islamic-based terrorism. It seems that the words terrorism and Islam apparently couldn't be used in the same sentences. The Brotherhood demanded retraining or purges of those at the White House involved with any of those materials. Shortly thereafter, Coughlin reports, John Brennan, a senior White House aide who is now director of the CIA, responded, "We share your sense of concern over these recent unfortunate incidents and are moving forward to ensure problems are addressed with a keen sense of urgency." Brennan directed that the White House immediately create an interagency task force to address the problem and said that the people or the documents that the Muslim Brotherhood deemed biased, false, and highly offensive would be removed. This was part of a pattern and practice of the White House going out of its way to placate the Brotherhood, even sending senior officials such as the FBI director to meet with the Brotherhood over the objections of Congress. The Brotherhood's campaign to intimidate and silence officials in Washington who link Islam and terrorism is working brilliantly. The 9/11 Commission report used the word jihad 126 times, Muslim 145 times, and Islam 322 times. A decade later, they have been virtually banished from official U.S. government documents. The FBI's counterterrorism analytical lexicon and the 2009 National Intelligence Strategy have zero mentions of jihad, Muslim, or Islam. Instead, they refer to violent extremism in general. This is madness. We need to see people and groups for what they really are, not what we want them to be. The Brotherhood is at the center of a civilization jihad. It is not bloody or violent yet, but it is just as threatening to the long-term survival of our Constitution as anything the Islamists in the Islamic State or Iran are planning. Lie number 13. Islam respects freedom of speech. The Quranic standard of speech promotes independent thought while encouraging respectful disagreement. In a sentence, Islam champions free speech while promoting a moral speech that obliges Muslims to attain a higher standard of wisdom. Author and attorney Kasim Rashid, USA Today. Our basic position is that the First Amendment means that everyone is free to be a bigot or even an idiot. Ibrahim Hooper, Council of American Islamic Relations, CARE. As Americans, we understand the importance of the right to free speech and freedom of expression. American Muslims value this right on behalf of every American citizen and would never shy away from ever defending this right. Islamic Circle of North America. On May 3, 2015, roommates Nadir Sufi and Elton Simpson drove 1,000 miles from Phoenix, Arizona, to the Curtis Caldwell Center in Garland, Texas, where the American Freedom Defense Initiative, AFDI, had gathered for its inaugural Muhammad art exhibit and contest. These two lone wolves, armed with AK-47 assault rifles and wearing body armor, rolled up to the convention center's entrance and opened fire on police and security guards posted outside. One security guard was shot in the ankle, but the nearly 200 people in attendance were fortunate that a police officer shot and killed both men before they could carry out a jihad-inspired act of mass murder. The FBI quickly established that Sufi and Simpson were radical Muslims who frequented ISIS chat boards, downloaded jihadist videos, and pledged allegiance to Amir ul-Mu'mineen, meaning the leader of the faithful in the Islamic State. ISIS, in fact, took credit for the attacks and promised that more would be coming. The Draw Muhammad contest and ADFI are the work of Pamela Geller, who may be the most tireless voice against homegrown jihadism and creeping Sharia in America today. She isn't afraid of making people uncomfortable by telling hard truths, and she's made plenty of enemies on both sides of the aisle as a result. Geller chose the Garland location because it was the same site where a Stand with the Prophet conference was held in January. She and about 2,000 supporters protested that event, which came just a few weeks after the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris. When Geller announced the $10,000 cartoon contest, she said, "This event will stand for free speech and show that Americans will not be cowed by violent Islamic intimidation. That is a crucial stand to take as Islamic assaults on the freedom of speech, our most fundamental freedom, are growing more insistent." Geller assured would-be attendees that the event would have heavy security, but added, "If we don't show the jihadis that they will not frighten us into silence, the jihad against freedom will only grow more virulent." It turns out that she was half right. Geller and her group showed they were not afraid to stand up for their rights in the face of real threats, but the jihad against freedom has become more virulent in spite of it. It wasn't surprising that ISIS claimed credit for inspiring the Garland attack, or that someone like Anjem Chowdhury, the media's go-to extremist imam, would tell Geller on Fox News that she knew the consequences of holding a contest that depicted Muhammad, an act that many Muslims, not just jihadists, believe is a grave insult. No, the real insult was the media's rush to condemn Geller and blame her free speech event for inspiring an act of jihadi violence. The Garland incident could not have been more clear-cut. Here was a group of Americans assembled peacefully to exercise their First Amendment rights, only to come under armed assault by men who wished to kill them for looking at cartoons. For their bravery in the face of terror, the New York Times presumed to tell Geller and her supporters that their freedom of speech was inferior to, well, to the sort of freedom of speech the Times deems more acceptable. There is no question that images ridiculing religion, however offensive they may be to believers, qualify as protected free speech in the United States and most Western democracies, the Times editors began in an editorial published a few days after the attack. There is also no question that however offensive the images, they do not justify murder, and that it is incumbent on leaders of all religious faiths to make this clear to their followers. The editorial should have ended there, short, sweet, and unobjectionable. Instead, the editors decided to ladle on heavy dollops of contempt for their fellow Americans. But, it is equally clear that the Muhammad art exhibit and contest in Garland, Texas, was not really about free speech. It was an exercise in bigotry and hatred, posing as a blow for freedom. To pretend that it was motivated by anything other than hate is simply hogwash. So the New York Times editorial board is populated with mind readers all of a sudden? They know with absolute certainty that Geller's event was all about bigotry and hatred and nothing else? Talk about hogwash. The Times editors weren't alone in missing the point. Journalists lined up to denounce the cartoon contest and basically accused Geller of walking alone in Mosul at night wearing a short skirt. Surely she knew what would happen next. Chris Matthews mused on MSNBC that Geller somehow set up Sufi and Simpson, as if they couldn't help but drive 15 hours to commit unspeakable acts of violence. Rukmini Kalamaki, a New York Times reporter who covers Islam and terrorism, took to Twitter to ask, "Free speech aside, why would anyone do something as provocative as hosting a Muhammad drawing contest? Free speech aside, You can't put it aside. It's the whole point. If Kalamaki had asked the same question of a rape victim, she would have been hounded off the internet and probably fired. But the media has different standards for outspoken conservative women who are unwilling to surrender their rights to religious zealots. CNN's Chris Cuomo berated Geller on his program, accusing her of planning the contest to spark a violent confrontation with crazy extremists who bought into an ideology that is sick. He then absurdly compared drawing pictures of Muhammad to an overused racial slur. The N-word gets treated the same way that depictions of Muhammad does, Cuomo said. We don't say it because it's offensive, not because legally I can't. We have reached the point where TV talking heads can no longer tell the difference between bona fide political speech and simple racist invective. On Fox News, Greta Van Susteren said that Geller's free speech rights should not trump police officers' safety. My message is simple. Protect our police. Do not recklessly lure them into danger, and that is what happened in Garland, Texas, at the Muhammad Cartoon Contest, she said at the top of her May 5th program. Yes, of course, there's a First Amendment right, and it's very important, but the exercise of that right includes using good judgment. There is actually no but in the First Amendment, and Greta seemed to forget that government exists to protect us and our rights, not the other way around. Despite the intensity of coverage, many news media outlets opted to blur out the images, seemingly relying on the theory of better safe than sorry. The truth is that our media and our politicians have been wobbling on freedom of speech for quite a while. When cartoons of Muhammad were originally published in the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten in 2005, they sparked protests and riots throughout Europe and the Middle East. At the time, to their lasting disgrace, the vast majority of major American newspapers, including the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, and Los Angeles Times, refused to show readers the cartoons that had caused so much havoc. Only a small number of publications, including the New York Sun, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the left-wing Harper's Magazine, printed even one of the controversial illustrations. Most chose to hide behind the fig leaf of religious sensitivity. As a spokesman for the Wall Street Journal explained, readers were well served by a short story without publishing the cartoon. We didn't want to publish anything that can be perceived as inflammatory to our readers' culture when it didn't add anything to the story. Apparently, journal readers couldn't be trusted to decide for themselves whether the cartoons were offensive or newsworthy. You might have at least expected the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists, AAEC, to join in solidarity with their colleagues in the Netherlands. If so, you'd have been disappointed. Just because you have the right to publish these, that does not mean you have the obligation, said Nick Anderson, who was the AAEC's vice president when the cartoon controversy reached its peak. He asserted without a shred of evidence that Jyllands-Posten's editors wanted to put a stick in the eye of their local clerics and did this intentionally, belittled and mocked the founder of a religion. He told the New York Times that the few U.S. newspapers that published the cartoons had fallen into a trap. If you're doing it in solidarity, look at with whom you're expressing solidarity. Anderson should have taken his own advice and looked into the cartoonists and editors he claimed had no motivation other than to aggravate Muslims. He might have found some insight in the editorial by Fleming Rose, Jyllands-Posten's cultural editor, who explained the newspaper's reasons for publishing the cartoons. Modern, secular society is rejected by some Muslims, Rose argued. They demand a special position, insisting on special consideration of their own religious feelings. It is incompatible with contemporary democracy and freedom of speech, where one must be ready to put up with insults, mockery, and ridicule. It is certainly not always attractive and nice to look at, he continued, and it does not mean that religious feelings should be made fun of at any price, but that is of minor importance in the present context. We are on our way to a slippery slope where no one can tell how the self-censorship will end. That is why Morne Vesen Jyllands-Posten has invited members of the Danish Editorial Cartoonist Union to draw Muhammad as they see him. By the time the 12 cartoons had circulated widely, along with two fabricated, deliberately incendiary images depicting Muhammad with a pig snout and a dog mounting a Muslim bowed in prayer, the newspaper's editors and cartoonists were overwhelmed with death threats. Many were forced into hiding, and a few cartoonists still require 24-hour police protection to this day. Rose later explained that he didn't believe at first that publishing the illustrations had anything to do with traditional freedom of speech. "I said that this act was about self-censorship, not free speech," he told Daniel Pipes of the Middle East Quarterly. "Free speech is on the books. We have the law, and nobody as yet has thought of rewriting it. This changed when the death threats were issued. It became an issue of the Sharia trumping the fundamental right of free speech. That fundamental right has been trampled even further in the years since. The Charlie Hebdo massacre helped cement the media's new ethos of self-censorship and cowardice." Yilin's Posten provided a sadly ironic coda to that horrific day with another editorial, this time explaining why the newspaper would not republish any cartoons or illustrations. "We have lived with the fear of a terrorist attack for 9 years, and yes, that is the explanation why we do not reprint the cartoons, whether it be our own or Charlie Hebdo's," Yilin's Posten's editors admitted. "We are also aware that we therefore bow to violence and intimidation. It shows that violence works." Islam apologists go to great lengths to attempt to disconnect these acts of violence from Islamic doctrine, to present them as something unrelated to the religion's core tenets. University of Michigan professor Christiane Gruber wrote in the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo attacks that there was actually no ban on using Muhammad's image in Islam. She cited a number of examples of Muhammad's image being used in the past and claimed there was no justification in the Quran or elsewhere in Islamic law to support such a ban. Widening the lens, others argue that Islam actually welcomes and protects free speech, making the act of killing someone who offends the religion distinctly un-Islamic. Kasim Rashid, a lawyer and author, condemned the Paris attacks and noted in a USA Today op-ed that the Quran promotes independent thought and that Islam champions free speech. He even provided verses from the Quran in support, claiming that instead of violence, Muslims are encouraged to exercise respectful disagreement. For instance, he cited Surah 5:9, which reminds believers to "let not a people's enmity incite you to act otherwise than with justice." Ibrahim Hooper, the national spokesman for CARE, wrote that "Islamic traditions include a number of instances of the Prophet having the opportunity to strike back at those who attacked him, but refraining from doing so." Russell Brand, the alleged comedian who likes to generate publicity by ignorantly charging into political debates, offered an even less informed argument, asking in disbelief, "How can any spiritual scripture be used as justification for mass murder?" He maintained that the Charlie Hebdo killers do not represent Islam any more than George Bush, Tony Blair, and Halliburton, invoking the war in Iraq, represented Christianity. Muslims and others understandably want to separate these attacks from mainstream Islam. You can either take their word for it, or you can do the research and look into Islamic law and teachings for yourself. Among the things you will find, an established tradition that prohibits use of the Prophet's image and constrictions on free speech, especially when the Prophet is involved. An Islamic text known as the Ash-Shifa by Qadi Iyad, described by its current publisher as perhaps the most frequently used and commented upon handbook in which the Prophet's life, his qualities, and his miracles are described in every detail, is very specific about what must be done with those who disrespect Muhammad. "Know that all who curse Muhammad, may Allah bless him and grant him peace, or blame him or attribute imperfection to him and his person, his lineage, his deen, religion, or any of his qualities, or alludes to that or its like by any means whatsoever, whether in the form of a curse or contempt or belittling him or detracting from him or finding fault with him or maligning him, the judgment regarding such a person is the same as the judgment against anyone who curses him. He is killed, as we shall make clear. This judgment extends to anything which amounts to a curse or disparagement. We have no hesitation concerning this matter, be it a clear statement or allusion." In the next section, the Ash-Shifa provides succinct instruction from Al-Husayn ibn Ali, son of the fourth caliph and grandson of the Prophet through Muhammad's daughter Fatima. According to Al-Husayn ibn Ali, Muhammad said, "Whoever curses a prophet, kill him. Whoever curses my companions, beat him. Qadi Iyad's writings clearly justify and go on to establish scholarly consensus for violence against anyone who exercises their free speech in a way derogatory toward Muhammad. There is no room for compromise whatsoever when it comes to the honor or dignity of the Prophet Muhammad. This also applies to depicting his image, according to modern Islamic scholar Azam Tamimi. The Quran itself doesn't say anything, but it is accepted by all Islamic authorities that the Prophet Muhammad and all the other prophets cannot be drawn and cannot be produced in pictures because they are, according to Islamic faith, infallible individuals, role models, and therefore should not be presented in any manner that might cause disrespect for them. Another modern cleric, Sheikh Ibrahim Moghra, presented the issue in even simpler terms. Islam in general specifically forbids the usage of imagery, and when it comes to depicting the messenger Muhammad, peace be upon him, that prohibition becomes even more relevant. We are not allowed to depict him in any shape, any way, or form. When the creators of the animated TV comedy series South Park sought to depict an image of Muhammad in an episode in 2006, the mere suggestion sparked an outcry among Muslim groups. A radical Muslim organization issued a death threat, saying that the show's creators, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, would be murdered like Theo van Gogh, who was killed in 2004 after producing a documentary on the mistreatment of women in Islamic societies. The threats against the South Park creators included lines from a sermon by Al-Qaeda Imam Anwar al-Awlaki, who said that anyone defaming Muhammad should be murdered. Harming Allah and His Messenger is a reason to encourage Muslims to kill whoever does that. Executives at the Comedy Central Network, which produced the show, panicked. Muslims all over the world had rioted after what they considered an insulting depiction of the Prophet appeared in a Danish newspaper. The executives feared similar reprisals. The controversy baffled South Park's creators. This, after all, was a program that regularly offended Catholics, Jews, Mormons, and many others. "We can do whatever we want to Jesus, and we have," said creator Matt Stone. "We've had him say bad words, we've had him shoot a gun, we've had him kill people. We can do whatever we want. But Muhammad, we couldn't just show a simple image." The executives at Comedy Central folded. Instead of depicting Muhammad in the episode, South Park ran a black screen that read, "Comedy Central has refused to broadcast an image of Muhammad on their network." The South Park guys rejected claims that the network was simply being tolerant to Muslims. "No, you're not," Stone replied in an interview with ABC News. "You're afraid of getting blown up. That's what you're afraid of. Comedy Central copped to that, you know. We're afraid of getting blown up." Under the Islamic idea of free speech, some things simply cannot be discussed, well, freely. This is explained by renowned Sharia scholar Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who maintains that Islam stresses the principle of freedom, but with a catch. This freedom is guaranteed on the condition that religion should not be toyed with and people's honor and dignity should not be transgressed upon. A 2012 Pew Research Center analysis found that nearly a quarter of the world's countries and territories, many in the Muslim world, have anti-blasphemy laws or policies on the books. As the report noted, the legal punishments for such transgressions vary from fines to death. A list of those countries includes Islamic nations such as Algeria, Egypt, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Jordan, Oman, Qatar, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. And as we detail in other sections of this book, many Islamic societies certainly don't allow free expression for women, non-Muslims, or gays. Some of these blasphemy cases make headlines internationally. In 2013, a blogger in Tunisia was jailed for insulting Islam. The following year, in Pakistan, a popular TV station was attacked by the government for blasphemy, for playing a song that was considered offensive to the Muslim faith. As Reuters reported, blasphemy carries the death penalty in Pakistan, but is not defined by law. Anyone who says their religious feelings have been hurt for any reason can file a case. Even more disturbing is that many countries, including the United States, are trying to make Islam's narrow version of free speech part of international law. In an example of the power of the Islamic agenda and of the eagerness of the American political establishment to go along in the spirit of cooperation, Muslim countries have succeeded in persuading the United Nations to pass a resolution that seeks to criminalize certain types of speech that might offend Islam. This is part of a long-standing effort by Muslim leaders to have the United Nations adopt an international resolution to counter Islamophobia and to call upon all states to enact laws to counter it, including deterrent punishment. In March 2011, these apologists began to get their wish. The United Nations Human Rights Council passed Resolution 1618, which encourages countries to foster a domestic environment of religious tolerance, peace, and respect by, among other things, adopting measures to criminalize incitement to imminent violence based on religion or belief. The seemingly innocuous resolution was pushed by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, a group consisting of 57 Muslim nations and enthusiastically supported by the United States. Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State at the time, called it an important statement that must be followed by sustained commitment. Of course, the entire purpose of this resolution was not to protect Christians or Jews being persecuted in the Muslim world, but to censor anyone from daring to offend Islam. Clinton admitted as much on July 15, 2011, when she traveled to Turkey to meet with the Secretary General of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Ekmelettin İnsanoğlu. There, standing with Islamic leaders, she pledged to help the OIC pass the resolution in the UN and to use some old-fashioned techniques of peer pressure and shaming to silence Americans who don't toe the line. The OIC Secretary General himself told a French television station that he was in favor of stopping the publication of Muhammad cartoons, and that those who continue to do so will face the consequences. "If you don't respect the feelings of 1.5 billion people, and if you don't feel yourself responsible not to insult them," he said, "then we have a problem." Failure to avoid criticism of the Prophet, he went on to add, would lead to demonstrations and violence. The OIC's demands have real international implications. Not shadowy extremists, but representatives of actual governments, nearly 60 in fact, have demanded that Western nations suppress speech that casts Islam in a bad light, notes Jeremy Rabkin, a professor at the George Mason University School of Law. But the United States under the Obama administration seems to be firmly on board with this idea. After all, our country's top diplomat, acting in an official capacity, went to a foreign land and vowed to foreign leaders that the United States government would use extra legal practices to shame and intimidate American citizens to stop them from exercising what should be their constitutional First Amendment right to free speech. The repercussions from this are only just beginning to be felt. According to at least one survey, American Muslims have similarly restrictive views, placing religious restrictions above their adopted country's constitutional protections. When asked, "Do you believe that criticism of Islam or Muhammad should be permitted under the Constitution's First Amendment?" 58% of U.S. Muslims surveyed replied no. Of course, it's easy to be a fan of free speech and the First Amendment when people say things you agree with. It's much harder when you try to imagine upholding the right of someone to say the most offensive thing imaginable to you. And that is the entire point. The depictions of Muhammad may well be offensive to some, just as putting Christ in urine and calling it art may be offensive to others. I may not like protests at soldiers' funerals or the fact that some in the media openly mock my Mormon religion, but I will stand up for their right to do it. When we kowtow to anyone or anything and hold it up as being so sacred that it is above reproach, we've not only lost our spines, we've lost our freedom. Part 3. What can be done? Truth advances and error recedes step by step only. And to do our fellow men the most good in our power, we must lead where we can, follow where we cannot, and still go with them, watching always the favorable moment for helping them to another step. Thomas Jefferson, 1814. On June 26, 2015, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled in favor of gay marriage. In the United States, this led to an outcry among those disagreeing with the decision. In the Middle East, it led to butchery. Members of ISIS threw homosexuals off the roof of a building. On social media, they even used the hashtag #LoveWins to mock the court's decision. That same month, ISIS put other victims in a steel cage and lowered them into a pool of water. Cameras were attached to the cage so that a global audience could watch these infidels suffer a horrific death as the water rose to the roof of the cage, drowning those inside. Still another set of victims had wires put around their necks so a video camera could record their heads being blown off. None of these shocking forms of murder is going to make most of the world care. And here's why. We've been deceived. We've been rendered blind. We've been trained by phony politicians in Washington to focus on bogus injustices on the home front, the so-called wars on women or against gays. There is a war against women going on, to be sure. There is a war against gays underway. But these wars are not here in America. They are over there. They are in the Muslim world. But we don't hear Lena Dunham or George Takei talking about that. Try to lecture a gay man in Iran, if one dared to surface, about American intolerance to homosexuals, and he'd laugh at you. Tell a Yazidi refugee about the plight of American women being denied birth control, and she'd scoff at you. The petty nonsense we preoccupy ourselves with in America is laughable. Even worse, it's dangerous. There simply is no comparison. Real injustices are happening right now in plain view, but we can't see them since so many contrived, phony injustices are constantly placed in our way. We have to start over. We have to get back to basics. We have to relearn how to become strong men and women, strong in faith, strong in values and principles. We have to reset our own priorities and then lead others to the light. Jihad's cost to civilization is incalculable. Over the centuries, Muslim armies have burned libraries, razed cities, and conquered large swaths of the Middle East, Asia, Africa, and Europe. They have enslaved, starved, and massacred millions of men, women, and children, all in the name of Islam. As we've seen, the jihadists are not distorting their religion. They believe they're acting in accordance with their faith, and they can cite chapter and verse to justify every beheading, crucifixion, act of vandalism, and degradation of the infidels who happen to get in their way. Our elected leaders often refuse to acknowledge these facts. President Obama says our enemies are people who have perverted Islam. President George W. Bush said that Al-Qaeda terrorists were traitors to their own faith, trying in effect to hijack Islam itself. Their reticence is understandable in some ways. The Bush administration wanted to head off accusations that the United States was at war with Islam, and by extension more than 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide. President Bush, in fact, often described the war on terror as a war against individuals who absolutely hate what America stands for, and as a war against evil, not against Islam. The problem with those descriptions is that they obscure who we're fighting and what victory might look like. There's no question that evil does exist, but it has a name, Islamism. Saying that Islamism has nothing to do with Islam is like saying that a particular cut of beef has nothing to do with a cow. They are inexorably linked. One grows inside the other. There are plenty of ways to practice Islam and plenty of choices in cuts of steak. But they all come from the same place. President Obama himself said in a CNN interview in February 2015 that there is an element growing out of Muslim communities in certain parts of the world that have embraced a nihilistic, violent, almost medieval interpretation of Islam. But, he then added, it is absolutely true that I reject a notion that somehow creates a religious war because the overwhelming majority of Muslims reject that interpretation of Islam. They don't even recognize it as being Islam. In reality, tens of millions of Muslims do recognize it as being Islam. It does no good to sugarcoat the truth. Our leaders may say we're not fighting a religious war, but the jihadists most certainly are. This book is a start at arming you with the truth, but it's just a start. We have to do more. An educated citizenry needs to fight back, and here's how to do it. 1. We must understand the enemy. We cannot be afraid to understand our opponents domestically or internationally on their own terms defined by the rules and teachings that motivate them and organize their philosophy. Yet our inability, or perhaps our unwillingness, to come to terms with an enemy that openly declares its philosophy, the laws under which it operates, and its goals, is a reflection of what our society has become. Our willful blindness, whether due to political correctness or outright fear, is killing us. Too many Americans still take at face value the lies of our nation's leaders that Islam is fundamentally a religion of peace and that the likes of ISIS, Boko Haram, and Al-Qaeda have distorted it and are therefore not Islamic. We also take for granted the separation of church and state in America, but there is no separation of mosque and state in Orthodox Islam. The only true law is the law of Allah. As we've heard throughout this audiobook, Islamic rules of war and for the proper subjugation of pagans, Christians, and Jews have been spelled out clearly for Muslims from the very beginning, more than 1,400 years ago. Their teachings about war, conquest, and submission remain central to Orthodox Islam today. Those messages are heard every Friday in mosques from Ann Arbor and Boston to London and Cairo, and all the way to Islamabad and Jakarta. ISIS is literally razing the birthplace of human civilization in Iraq and Syria to build a new caliphate. In early 2015, the Islamic State pillaged and smashed priceless artifacts in Iraq's Mosul Museum. A masked ISIS spokesman explained in a video that the ancient Assyrians and Akkadians were polytheists, so it was right to destroy what remained of their civilization. These statues and idols, these artifacts, if God has ordered its removal, they became worthless to us even if they are worth billions of dollars. Soon afterward, ISIS vandals demolished the ruins of Hatra, a key stronghold and trade center of the Parthian Empire, which had been a major power in ancient Persia some 2,000 years ago. They also pillaged and demolished hundreds of artifacts in the ancient Assyrian city of Nimrud, where the Tower of Babel once stood, before leveling the entire place with explosives. In some cases, ISIS's religious objections to supposed idols are secondary to making a profit off them. The group has smuggled and sold millions of dollars worth of ancient artifacts. They steal everything that they can sell, and what they can't sell, they destroy, said Iraq's Deputy Minister for Antiquities and Heritage. Boko Haram, a group whose name translates roughly to "Western education is forbidden," has slaughtered thousands of Christians in Nigeria. The group, which formally pledged allegiance to the Islamic State in March 2015, takes Christian girls as young as 9 or 10 years old as sexual slaves. Boko Haram's leader, Abubakar Shekau, is completely unapologetic about the practice. "There are slaves in Islam," he said in 2014. "You should know this. Prophet Muhammad took slaves himself during the Badr War." The Badr War was the decisive battle in AD 624, that led to Muhammad's conquest of his home city of Mecca and eventually the entire Arabian Peninsula. 21st century jihadists would like nothing more than to repeat that history. Jihad's depredations aren't limited to the Middle East, Africa, or South Asia. Al-Qaeda made its intentions and its total rejection of Western norms known to the United States and to the world long before Osama bin Laden became a household name. A document discovered in Manchester, England, called the Al-Qaeda Manual, in fact transparently lays out the organization's mission. "The confrontation that we are calling for with the apostate regimes does not know Socratic debates, Platonic ideals, nor Aristotelian diplomacy. But it knows the dialogue of bullets, the ideals of assassination, bombing and destruction, and the diplomacy of the cannon and the machine gun. Islamic governments have never and will never be established through peaceful solutions and cooperative councils. They are established as they have always been, by pen and gun, by word and bullet, and by tongue and teeth." Never before in our history has the United States had to account for the personal and private beliefs of its enemies. When the United States fought Nazism and fascism, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New York Times didn't say, "Not all Germans," or "Not all Italians." Most Americans understood that not all Russians wanted to eradicate the United States during the Cold War. Nevertheless, the regimes of Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and Soviet Russia were implacable foes and existential threats to our way of life. They needed to be defeated militarily and ideologically. The same must be said of Muslims who rally under the black flag of jihad. In February 2015, the left-leaning Atlantic magazine published a blockbuster story by Graham Wood titled, What ISIS Really Wants. I talked about it at length on my radio program. The article is a must-read for anyone who seeks genuine understanding about the Islamic State's goals. Wood begins by assuring his readers that nearly all Muslims reject ISIS, but, he writes, pretending that the Islamic State isn't actually a religious millenarian group with theology that must be understood to be combated has already led the United States to underestimate it and back foolish schemes to counter it. Wood points out that many Americans tend to see jihadism as monolithic and to apply the logic of Al-Qaeda to an organization that has decisively eclipsed it. That's a mistake, he argues. I agree with Wood that while there are different shades of jihad, all of those factions rely on the same holy book, traditions, and religious laws. More important, Wood argues, the Islamic State's jihadists are not modern secular people with modern political concerns wearing medieval religious disguise. In fact, much of what the group does looks nonsensical except in light of a sincere, carefully considered commitment to returning civilization to a 7th century legal environment and ultimately to bringing about the apocalypse. As we've seen, the voices of jihad have made their purpose plain again and again. They are bent on a new Holocaust, one that engulfs Christians and Jews in the Middle East and around the world. So how many more innocent Christians need to be crucified or beheaded until we start taking ISIS at its word? How many Jews have to die before we understand that Hezbollah and Hamas, along with their patrons in Iran, really mean what they say about wiping Israel off the map? It's true that many Muslims in the United States and abroad reject and condemn violent jihad, but it doesn't follow that the violent jihadists of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and their confederates are not truly Islamic. And it certainly doesn't mean that Muslims reject everything that ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the others espouse. A 2013 Pew poll found sizable minorities of Muslims in 11 countries, including nominal U.S. allies, held favorable views of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Hezbollah. 1 in 5 Egyptians approve of Al-Qaeda's work, while 23% of Indonesians, a nation with a moderate Muslim population of more than 202 million, the largest on earth, say they support the terrorist group's goals. Overall, about 1/3 of Muslims approve of Hamas, and 1 in 4 think highly of Hezbollah. If that isn't worrisome enough, 15% of Muslims in Turkey support suicide bombing, and a little over half of all Turks whom Pew surveyed say they aren't the least bit worried about Islamic extremism. Don't forget, Turkey is a NATO ally that has long aspired to join the European Union. Islamism's resurgence in the former seat of the Ottoman Empire appeared to suffer a setback in June 2015 when President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Justice and Development Party lost its parliamentary majority for the first time since 2002. It's a hopeful sign, but whether extremism begins to lose its appeal in Turkey remains to be seen. Apologists for jihad, whether it's the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, agenda-driven pseudo-academics such as Karen Armstrong and Juan Cole, or their stenographers in the mainstream press, insist against all evidence to the contrary that the ideology of ISIS and Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda comes from nowhere. Even our military's top brass seemingly cannot grasp the enemy's religious aims or theological appeal. The New York Times in 2014 highlighted the work of a special civilian task force assembled by Major General Michael K. Nagata, commander of U.S. Special Operations Forces in the Middle East, to make sense of ISIS and its goals. "We do not understand the movement, and until we do, we are not going to defeat it," Nagata said, according to confidential minutes of a conference call with several experts that the Times obtained. "We have not defeated the idea. We do not even understand the idea." The report relates how Nagata's team consists of more than 3 dozen outside experts, including business professors and neuroscientists, to figure out the intangible means the Islamic State uses to control large populations and the magnetic, inspirational way ISIS attracts so many young men and women from around the globe to fight. I do not understand the intangible power of ISIL, Nagata said. This may sound like a bizarre excursion into the surreal, but for me, it is about avoiding failure. General Nagata is right to worry about failure. We are failing. But with all due respect to the general, who has served his country with distinction for more than 3 decades in some of the worst places on Earth, he won't find the answer he's looking for in cutting-edge neuroscience or marketing research. Our cultural and political elite may be steeped in secularism and liberalism, but our enemies are deadly serious about their faith and traditions. When ISIS leader Caliph Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi says, "O Muslims, Islam was never for a day the religion of peace, Islam is the religion of war," he means it. When al-Baghdadi says, "Your prophet was dispatched with the sword as a mercy to the creation, he was ordered with war until Allah is worshipped alone," he isn't being obtuse. When the self-proclaimed caliph quotes Muhammad addressing the polytheists of Arabia and says, "I came to you with slaughter," he never for a day grew tired of war, that isn't a mixed message in need of expert parsing. Why is that so difficult to understand? Stop and think about the madness of our nation's cultural and political elite. They lack the moral and intellectual clarity to win this religious war. They cannot tell friend from foe. They're ignorant of the lessons of history. They have no courage of their convictions because their convictions are hollow. If we rely on them to understand our enemy, it will be too late. It's up to us. 2. We must be unafraid to speak. Do not be deceived. Our enemies understand better than our leaders do that jihad is expansive, and so is our enemy's desire to change America. They would have us cower in fear and shame, censoring our thoughts and words in accordance with their standards. Gradually, they expect the United States, through guilt and well-intended tolerance, will submit to Sharia law and eventually to the caliphate. Given all that we've seen and learned in the years following the 9/11 attacks, it still comes as a shock to see how the highest levels of the United States government have pandered to Muslim radicals. As noted, the Obama administration has welcomed members of the Muslim Brotherhood to the White House and to meetings with representatives of the State Department. This pattern is not unique to President Obama, however. The Bush administration made similar overtures to Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. According to the Clarion Project, President Bush was due to meet personally with Muslim leaders, many with Brotherhood connections, in 2001. One of the invitees, Abdurrahman Alamoudi, had also met with officials in the Clinton administration. Alamoudi would later be sentenced to 23 years in prison for plotting with Libyans to assassinate the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. That meeting, which was to happen on September 11th, was, of course, canceled. But President Bush, along with every other American, nonetheless became well acquainted with radical Islam that day. These are the people our government apparently listens to. It has gone on for years. If we want those in power to instead listen to the American people, we have to make sure they cannot ignore our message. We must understand the truth, and once armed with that knowledge, we cannot be afraid to speak up. The most deadly thing the jihadists can do, short of detonating a nuclear weapon or electromagnetic pulse, is to get us to subvert our own precariously dangling constitution to accommodate them. That plan of attack is already well underway. We've already seen how criticism of Islam or Muslims is routinely denounced as Islamophobia. We've seen how intimidation, fear, and violence are directed against people who dare speak out. We witnessed the disgraceful media response to the thwarted terrorist attack on the Draw Muhammad contest in Garland, Texas, which laid the blame for a shootout that left 2 ISIS-inspired gunmen dead on the free speech event's organizers. And we've seen how the Brotherhood's civilization jihad is working in parallel to the more violent jihadist efforts in the Middle East. You would think our press would recognize the threat. After all, aren't they in the First Amendment business? Haven't the New York Times and other newspapers insisted on publishing U.S. secrets in the fight against Al-Qaeda in the name of the public's right to know? Yet at the same time, they've gone out of their way to deny, deflect, and deceive the public when it comes to the truth about jihad and radical Islam. They seem to be in total denial that Islamic extremists pose a bona fide threat or that a caliphate is something that anybody, let alone tens of millions of Muslims, actually wants. 14 years after 9/11, the press, with few exceptions, still refuses to consider the possibility that a terrorist plot or attack may be the work of jihadists with global designs rather than a simple lone wolf or disgruntled individual who happens to be Muslim.